Gute Unterhaltung.
Welcome to the June 2016 edition of Spotlight Audio. I'm David Creedon from Britain. Join me now for a 60-minute expedition around the English-speaking world with stories, language tips, and exercises. Afternoon tea is one of the great British traditions. We learn about its history and tell you how to bake a delicious cake to go with your sandwiches and scones. The great country houses of Ireland give visitors a fascinating look at a long-gone age of wealth and power. Enjoy the amazing architecture and beautiful gardens in our travel section. As the UK votes on leaving the European Union, we get opinions from our columnists and hear what the people on the street have to say. England can be proud of many great cultural exports. Shakespeare, the Beatles, the English language itself. Another great on that list is the game of football, or soccer if you're an American. Modern football originated in Britain in the 19th century. The first printed rules of the game were produced in 1863, and Sheffield United, from South Yorkshire, has the honour of being the world's oldest football club. But what about the English national football team? They won the 1966 World Cup against West Germany, but since then success has evaded them, and they have yet to win a European Championship. Perhaps their luck will change when they compete this month in the UEFA Euro 2016 finals. The most important person for them in the coming tournament is the English manager Roy Hodgson. Listen now to find out more about the man.
Who exactly is Roy Hodgson? You don't have to be a great football player to be a great manager. Roy Hodgson, the manager of the national football team of England, was only a moderately successful player, but he's had a fantastic career helping teams to win. Hodgson, 68, was born in Surrey, England. He went to school with another future football manager, Bob Houghton. The two men often worked together, first in England and later in Sweden, where they became known as English Roy and English Bob. After playing for the London club Crystal Palace, Hodgson trained to become a football manager. He then worked as a teacher for a few years. He told the British Coaches Abroad Association, "In my first teaching job in Dulwich, all I ever did was coach football. I never stepped foot in a classroom or gymnasium." In 1976, Hodgson got a job as manager of the Swedish club Halmstad. He later helped Switzerland's national team qualify for the 1994 FIFA World Cup and again in 1996 for the UEFA European Football Championship. Unusual in the world of football, the Englishman speaks Italian, Norwegian, Swedish and German. In the past 40 years, Hodgson has managed 16 different teams in 8 countries. He now hopes to lead England to victory in the 2016 UEFA European Championship, which starts in France on the 10th of June and continues until the 10th of July.
For some people, visiting a library just isn't possible. So for elderly people, school children, and those living in a rural community, the book mobile is a blessing. Jessica Moran works for the Tillamook County Library as the book mobile driver. Tillamook County is located in the northeast of the U.S. state of Oregon. Listen now as Moran gives some examples of the things she does and the people she meets during her daily route. By the way, the word route is pronounced route in U.S. English. Some words are missing from this text in your audio booklet. As you listen, see if you can fill them in. You'll find the answers printed below.
I usually get to work about 8:30 in the morning. The first thing I do is I check my email to see if there's any important news I missed. Then I do what's called our send list, which is a list of books that I need to pull from my bookmobile to send to other libraries because patrons want them. Then after I do that, I check in the books that are sent to me from other libraries. Then I check my schedule to make sure I know what day I'm doing, because every day of work is a different schedule. And today I'm going to take you on my Thursday A route. And so in the morning, I leave during the school year about 9 o'clock, and my first stop is at a Head Start, which is a school for children who need a little help and are of low-income families. And I go there, and I go into the classroom, and I bring the 15 or so students onto the bookmobile. I read them a couple short stories. Then they get to pick out some books, and they go back into the classroom. My next stop takes me to Five Rivers Retirement Center, which is a home for elderly. And I go in, and I meet my patrons. Henrietta Davis is usually sitting there waiting for me for her movies, along with five other patrons who enjoy their various items, books on CD, tapes, books, and various other things. And I deliver them to their rooms, have a short conversation, help them with any questions they have. Then I go to what's called Evergreen Apartments, which is low-income housing for elderly. And I go and I visit a woman by the name of Gloria Davis. And I go in and I bring her her books and her movies and I chat with her for about 20 minutes because I'm one of the few visitors that she gets every day.
Thursday, the 23rd of June, could be one of the most important days in the history of the United Kingdom. On this day, a referendum will be held to decide whether the state should remain a member of the European Union. The word on everyone's lips is Brexit, which is a short way of describing the withdrawal of the UK from the EU. Brexit is a combination of the words Britain and exit. We'll hear a number of opinions on the referendum over the course of this month's Spotlight Audio. First, let's listen to what our British columnist Colin Beavan has to say. By the way, Colin refers to the use of animated meerkats in a series of TV adverts. These TV meerkats are supposed to be Russian, so don't be surprised that our speaker has given the meerkats in the article a Russian accent.
Which way to utopia? We'll soon have our referendum about leaving the EU. I shall vote to stay in. The EU is not perfect, but the arguments we hear from those who want Britain to leave often seem questionable. We're told, for example, that the money we'd save would bring growth and jobs. Yes, economic growth here could be better, but it's productivity that's so poor. Will productivity improve if we say goodbye to the EU? And will exports? We're good at buying from abroad, but we really need to sell more. True, more jobs would be welcome, but employment in the UK is not a disaster. Strangely, there have never been more people here with jobs than now. This has happened within the EU. Would there be more if Britain left? I'm not sure that arguments matter, though. Belief seems to be more important. Belief in utopia. Some seem to think it's just round the corner, that we'd already be there if it weren't for the EU. Funnily enough, when Britain agreed to start preparing for the single European market in 1986, we also thought we were on our way to utopia. 30 years later, and exactly 500 years after Sir Thomas More's book Utopia was first published, this island is still hard to find on the map. If we had found it, Utopia would now be a member of the European Union, and we'd flock there to buy ourselves holiday homes. These competing visions of Utopia are confusing. One needs to compare the market to find the best deal, which is basically what David Cameron tried to do. What's wrong with wanting to save money? Generally, one goes online. There are websites that give you price comparisons and tell you if you're paying too much for your insurance, electricity, or bank account. Sadly, there isn't one for international relations. But there is one that uses meerkats. Animated versions of these creatures star in advertisements. As a joke, they tell us not to get confused when words are similar. They remind us that their website exists to compare markets, not meerkats. The meerkats on TV are supposed to be charming. Real ones, when you see them at the zoo, are irritatingly hyperactive. They seem to keep changing their minds. You can just imagine them checking their gas and electricity bills every 5 minutes and switching to a firm that costs less, or comparing their political expenses. "We've been paying far too much for our trade agreements, but we found a better deal from Asia, so we've left the EU and switched." "What about your immigration? Where do you get that from?" "Well, we were with the EU, but we got a better deal by switching to the Commonwealth." "Do you still use the EU for peace insurance?" "We used to. We used it for supplementary cover, but it's so much cheaper just to use NATO." Will meerkat mentality decide our referendum? I hope not. Taking the advice of meerkats on day-to-day markets is fine. As for the future, though, that's much less clear-cut.
What do people on the streets of Britain think about a possible Brexit? Correspondent Lorraine Mallinder travelled to the town of Middlesbrough in North Yorkshire to get an idea of the mood of the general public. You're going to hear from some of the people she talked with. The people speak with a Northern English accent. If you don't understand something someone says, remember that the interviews are transcribed in your booklet. The first interview is with Hannah Dodsworth, a 22-year-old journalism student at Teesside University. She thinks the northeast of England would suffer if the UK left the European Union.
"I think we should stay in the EU for reasons such as funding. MIMA, an art gallery in Middlesbrough, is funded by the EU, and a lot of the arts and creative things around this area are all funded from the EU. So if that gets cut, then that's going to go. And, I mean, a lot of cuts have already taken place in the northeast as it is, so I think it will affect it even more if we're out of the EU."
Many voters are still undecided on the issue. Valentine Maduko, a 31-year-old science teacher, is worried about the economy.
"I'm not very sure yet because I haven't really thought about it. I'm more concerned about what policy it's going to have economically. So if it's going to be positive for the UK to leave the EU and affect it positively in terms of economy, then why not? But if it's not, then I don't think it's worth it."
A common complaint of those who want the UK to leave is that the EU decides on too many British laws and policies. Jean Maron is 64 and retired. She will be voting to leave the EU because she wants Britain to make its own decisions when it comes to areas like agriculture.
"When we first joined, it was all to do with trade, and now it's just changed completely and it's all to do with taking over our way of governing and everything. Farming, fishing, I don't know if it was a joke about bananas not being straight, cucumbers not being straight, and being able to call something something because, I don't know, we have to change things because of the EU.
In February of this year, British Prime Minister David Cameron made an agreement with 27 other European leaders on a new deal for the UK. One part of the deal involved EU migrants sending child benefits abroad. Cameron wanted a complete ban, but some eastern states rejected this. Now, child benefits for children living overseas are to be based on the cost of living in their home countries. For 48-year-old nurse Lisa Horrocks, such child benefits are a deciding factor in her voting to leave.
I think we should come out. I just think we should be responsible for ourselves and have a say in how our countries run, borders especially, and I think a lot of people feel that because of the immigrants, you know, coming in and things like that, people being here and claiming money for children who are not even in this country, but I'll definitely be voting out.
Other voters fear the economic consequences of a Brexit. Richard Yule is a 25-year-old online trader and will be voting to stay in the EU.
I just think it would be better for the whole country to stay in Europe because I think it would be better, like, economic-wise, definitely, like, better to stay in. Otherwise, I think the country's going to go to ruin, to be honest, if we leave.
It doesn't get more British than afternoon tea. We should first be clear that tea doesn't just refer to the drink itself. What we're talking about here is a light meal typically eaten between 4 and 6 in the afternoon. Nor is this just a meal, but also somewhat of a ritual. Anna Maria Russell, the 7th Duchess of Bedford, is popularly credited with starting the practice in the 1840s. A close friend of Queen Victoria, the Duchess wanted something light to keep her going until the fashionably late evening meal. Soon she began inviting her friends, and a tradition was born. Afternoon tea typically consists of small sandwiches, scones served with clotted cream and jam, and cakes and pastries. By the way, clotted cream is a very thick type of cream made by slowly heating milk. Of course, there's also tea to drink. Traditionally, loose tea brewed in a teapot and served with milk and sugar. In the June issue of Spotlight, you can find out more about the history of afternoon tea. There are also recipes to inspire you to make a traditional afternoon tea at home. In the next track, Editor-in-Chief Inez Sharp will be here to show us how to bake a Victoria sponge cake, a classic accompaniment to afternoon tea. First, let's look at some of the vocabulary you're going to need. Caster sugar is a white sugar in the form of very fine grains. It's often used in cooking. Also common in the kitchen is flour. This is a fine white or brown powder made from grain, especially wheat. It's used to make bread, cakes and biscuits. Icing sugar is a fine white powder made from sugar. You can use it to dust the top of your cake. To dust is to cover something with powder.
Hello, I'm Inez Sharp, Editor-in-Chief of Spotlight, and today we're in the Spotlight Cafe. Actually, to be more precise, we're in the kitchens of the Spotlight Cafe, because today we're going to make a cake. We're going to make a Victoria sponge cake. I don't know if you've ever seen one or eaten one, been lucky enough to eat one. It's a very light cake made with eggs and flour and sugar, and it has a filling with lovely thick whipped double cream and strawberry jam and a little bit of icing sugar on top. So we're going to make that together. So listen carefully and we'll see how it turns out. The ingredients you need are 4 eggs, 200 grams of caster sugar, 200 grams of soft butter, 200 grams of flour, and 1 heaped teaspoon of baking powder. And then for the filling, you're going to need 250 millilitres of double cream. You can use normal whipping cream, but you should really whip it so it has a really good stiff consistency afterwards. Then you're going to need 6 tablespoons of strawberry jam. I recommend you take Tiptree, but that's our local jam. But any really good strawberry jam will do. And you need 1 tablespoon of icing sugar to dust the cake afterwards. That's just to put a little bit of icing sugar on top. Okay, so got your ingredients. We're ready to go. The first thing you're going to want to do is to heat your oven to 190 degrees Celsius or 375 degrees Fahrenheit. If you have a gas cooker, it'd be gas mark 5. Right, then you need to, let me try and find this. Am I looking for the butter here? Yeah, you need to grease 2 sandwich tins. Sandwich tins are small, round tins. And the reason why this is important is if you use a 24 centimetre or a bigger baking tin, you're going to get a very flat cake. And the point of the Victoria sponge is it's not a big cake, but it's a very light cake. So you grease your 2 20 centimetre sandwich tins. Then you put the sugar, let's see, we find that here, and the butter into the bowl, and you beat until the mix is smooth. Right, well, you can hear I'm doing this beating with a spoon. In fact, you'd be better off doing it with an electric mixer, unless you've got very good arm muscles. You'll get a better consistency with a mixer. So you mix that combination of the sugar and the butter until it's nice and smooth, and then you add in the eggs. Remember, 4 eggs, nice and slowly. So there we go. Okay, you're going to need 4 of those. I'll put the other ones in. Right, okay, mix those. Right, you're getting a nice smooth consistency here. And then finally, you're going to fold in the flour. Where do we have the flour? It's over here. Okay. And the baking powder. Okay, right. So in goes the baking powder, and then you mix it again. In fact, I'm going to use the electric mixer. So, okay, once you've got that lovely, smooth, light mixture, you're going to divide it between the 2 sandwich tins, half in each tin. Put the tins into the oven and bake them for around, let's say, 20 minutes. The best way to decide whether the cake is ready to be taken out, whether the 2 halves of the cake are ready to be taken out, is if you just take a fork or some other something soft like a wooden spoon, and just press the top of the cake, and it should be a nice golden brown, and it should be springy. It mustn't be super soft, otherwise it's not done. It should be nice and springy. Right. If they're done, then you take your 2 halves of the cake out of the oven, turn the cake upside down and spread the jam on 1 half. And on top of that, you put the whipped cream. So you've got a nice thick layer of whipped cream, and underneath that, the nice red of the strawberry jam. And then you place the second half of the cake on the top. So it's tis like a sandwich. And finally, this is my favourite bit because I like the sugary bit. Okay, you're going to dust it with some icing sugar. There you go. Right. Okay. Now, there we have a beautiful Victoria sponge cake, and all we need now is a nice cup of tea.
This month in Everyday English, we meet Maria and Simon. They've just moved into a new home and are having a housewarming party. What kind of words and phrases do they use to talk about this? In the first dialogue, Maria's friend Erin has come round to help with the party. Maria offers to give her the grand tour, to show her around their home.
Thank you so much for coming round to help, Erin. Do you want to do the grand tour first?
Of course I do. I'm dying to have a look round the place.
Well, you'll have to excuse the mess. There are still a few boxes to be unpacked and lights and stuff to be fixed. This is the kitchen.
Oh, it's gorgeous. You've got so much space and it's so light.
I know. I love it. As long as you can work in a kitchen, it's fine. That's the most important thing, I think.
You haven't had to do much work to the house at all, have you?
No, neither Simon nor I are DIY enthusiasts, so we knew we were looking for a house in move-in condition.
Did you hear Maria say that neither she nor Simon are DIY enthusiasts? An enthusiast is a person who's interested in something and spends a lot of time doing it. DIY stands for do it yourself and describes the activity of making, repairing, or decorating things in the home yourself. In the second dialogue, Maria and her friend Erin are making preparations for the party. Maria mentions a worktop. This is a flat surface in a kitchen where food can be prepared. A kitchen island is a worktop that you can access from all sides. And do you know the noun you can use to talk about knives, forks, and spoons? The noun is cutlery.
Where do you keep your plates, Maria?
Next to the dishwasher. But I've hired plates and glasses for the party. They're being delivered later on. Where should we put them?
Well, where are you having the buffet?
Either on the island or on the table. What do you think?
I think the island would be better so people can sit and eat at the table.
You're right. We could put the plates and cutlery beside the buffet and the glasses and drinks over here on the worktop.
I'm back. Does anyone want to give me a hand?
Coming!
In Around Oz, columnist Peter Flynn gives his opinion on a possible Brexit. Why should an Australian care about what happens in a nation on the other side of the world? Well, not only is Australia a former British colony, but it's also still a member of the Commonwealth of Nations, an association of states comprising the UK and many of its former colonies. Oh, and Elizabeth II is still the Queen of Australia. She's represented in Australia by a Governor-General and is represented in each Australian state by a Governor, each of which she appoints directly. The top left quarter of the Australian flag is even made up of the Union Jack.
Should Britain stay or should it go? Let's have a referendum to see if Australia wants to leave Asia and the Pacific region. That sounds silly, doesn't it? I think it's about as absurd an idea as Donald Trump's promise to build a wall along the border with Mexico to stop Latino killers and rapists from entering the US. That's all part of the presidential campaigner's plan to make America great again. Equally absurd are many of the arguments from those campaigning for Britain to leave the EU. London Mayor Boris Johnson sounded a bit Trump-like when he wrote that a Brexit would allow Britain to save money and take back control. Maybe he was nostalgically recalling a time when London was simply the capital of Great Britain, instead of being grateful that it is currently the financial capital of Europe. He gave examples of EU laws that say you can't recycle tea bags, or that children under 8 cannot blow up balloons. Really? Is that so important? No, I don't think this debate on stay or leave should have anything to do with history, other than to remind people that the British joined the old European common market way back in 1973. The biggest issue is the simplest, geography. Whether or not British voters choose to leave in this month's referendum, the UK will remain part of Europe. Prime Minister David Cameron may be regretting that his Conservative Party promised this vote during the last election campaign, but he has clearly spelled out the consequences for those who think an exit can lead to a better deal from Brussels. Back in February, Cameron told Parliament, "Sadly, I've known a number of couples who have begun divorce proceedings, but I don't know any who have begun divorce proceedings in order to renew their marriage vows." From down under here in Australia, it is difficult to understand how Britain could benefit from leaving the EU's single market. The freedom of movement enjoyed by Britons working in Europe would be lost, and many talented European workers would be dissuaded from moving to Britain. Of course, there is a racist and anti-immigration tone to Eurosceptic politics. Border control, as we know from Australia's Turn Back the Boat strategies, appeals to the xenophobes and nationalists. The fact is, though, that Britain is not being flooded with refugees or illegal migrant groups, whether they be Christians or Muslims. The rest of Europe is carrying that burden. British national statistics show there are about 1.7 million workers in the UK from Eastern and Western Europe, compared to nearly 3 million foreign workers, many from India and China, who come from outside the EU. Like it or not, we live in a global world. British voters can't turn the tide, no more than they can block the English Channel. There will be much interest here in this former colony in how the British vote, but either way, it won't change our sense of geography.
Welcome to Replay, the listening exercise in which we look at a recent news story, its background and language. I'm Inez Sharp. In this edition, the rise of religious persecution in the Middle East sees millions of Christians flee their traditional homelands. Christianity is under threat in the very region where it originated. In 1910, 14% of the population of the Middle East was Christian. Today, that number is down to 4%. In most of the region, Christians now suffer persecution because of their faith. In some countries, however, this persecution has become extreme, leading to an exodus of Christian people. Where should they go, and what should we do to help them? Ask the writers of an editorial from Britain's Guardian newspaper. In a moment, you can listen to three excerpts from that editorial. Now let's look at some of the language used in the first excerpt. The writers say that some of the Christian people of Iraq have found shelter in Kurdistan. Here, shelter means protection from danger or attack. You can take shelter from a storm, for example. Many Christian people have been displaced. In other words, they've been forced to move away from their homes to another place.
The long agony of the Christians of Iraq and Syria continues. These countries have a far older Christian tradition than Western Europe. It was to Damascus that St. Paul was travelling when he was struck down and converted. But it really does seem as if it is now coming to an end. More than a decade of war has seen the Christian people of Iraq driven from their homes, sometimes three times, as the front lines have passed over them, until a remnant has found shelter in Kurdistan. In Syria, the Christian minorities were somewhat sheltered by the Assad regime, which means these communities have a degree of sympathy for it that is not shared by the Western nations they look to as their other protectors. They too have been displaced in immense numbers.
The violence committed by Islamic State, also known as ISIS, in Syria and Iraq, is perhaps the greatest threat to Christians in that region. ISIS has targeted Christians and other minorities in an attempt to completely remove certain religious groups. In the second excerpt, the Guardian writers also talk about violence against Christians in areas outside the ISIS-controlled areas in Syria and Iraq. They describe this as murderous hostility. Hostility describes unfriendly or aggressive feelings or behaviour. In this context, the verb to slaughter means to kill a number of people violently.
In the territories controlled by Islamic State, the treatment of Christians, as of Yazidis, has been recognised as genocide by the US. It is ISIS that destroyed the ancient communities around Nineveh, now Mosul, and ISIS that has institutionalised the rape of captive women and children. In the rest of Syria and Iraq, the outbreaks of murderous hostility to Christians are much less organised, although both Sunni and Shia forces, when they are not slaughtering each other for their heresies, have proved capable of slaughtering Christians for their religions too. Nor should we forget the supposedly more moderate Sunni jihadis supported by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Any part of the world where crucifixion is deployed as a quasi-judicial punishment is one from which Christians have very good reasons to flee.
In the final excerpt, the Guardian writers look for possible solutions to the problem. One answer they rule out, however, is military intervention. They point to the results of the last war in Iraq as an example. They describe that war as a crime and folly. A folly is a foolish act or idea. Instead of the peaceful democratic country once hoped for, Iraq is now a ghastly or terrible wasteland. A wasteland is an ugly and often ruined place or area.
Where should they go? And what should we do to help them? Neither question has an easy answer. The fantasy that Western military intervention could ever produce a more secure and stable Middle East has been discredited since the invasion of Iraq. In the end, the conclusion of that crime and folly, as well as those of local actors, including the Assad regime, has been that Europe itself is less secure and stable, and the countries we supposedly liberated are a ghastly wasteland.
Let's see if you can remember the meanings of some of the words and phrases from the text. I'm going to give you a definition. Do you know the word or phrase that fits? Ready? What noun describes unfriendly or aggressive feelings or behaviour? Hostility. When people have been forced to move away from their home to another place, they have been displaced. This noun describes an ugly and often ruined place or area. Wasteland. What verb means to kill a number of people violently? To slaughter. What noun describes protection from danger or attack? Shelter. This word means a foolish act or idea. Folly. With that, we end replay for this month. We hope you've found our explanations useful. Till next month, goodbye.
The Big House has a special place in Irish history. The term refers to the country houses and mansions of the Anglo-Irish ruling class. This class was created mainly in the 16th and 17th centuries, when England gave huge areas of Irish land to British settlers. Until the birth of the Irish Free State in 1922, Anglo-Irish families controlled almost all the political and economic power in the country. The big houses were big, not just because of their size, but also because of their influence over the surrounding countryside. However, during the Irish Revolutionary period between 1916 and 1923, the IRA destroyed about 275 of these buildings. Today, many of the remaining big houses have become tourist destinations, drawing visitors who wish to enjoy the period architecture and glorious gardens of these stately homes. In the June travel feature, Claudine Weber-Hoff visits two surviving country houses. Listen now to an extract from the article.
In the garden. There's more than one kind of aristocracy in Ireland. Kristen Jameson, one of three daughters of the Jameson whiskey family, is too refined to say anything of the sort, but a visit to her home does the talking for her. Tour in House, in Capaquin, about an hour from Waterford, is a charming Italianate villa built in 1840. In spring and summer, Jameson opens the estate to the public as part of the Waterford Garden Trail, allowing visitors to see how the good life is lived in the Irish countryside. The Jameson family made a name for itself with Irish whiskey, starting in the late 18th century, and it is still well known. The brand is now owned by the French Pernod Ricard Consortium, which continues to make whiskey labelled with the Jameson name. Ms. Jameson welcomes me as part of a group of visitors in the drive before her elegant home. Waving us into the foyer, she hands each of us a glass of whiskey. As I drink it, I admire the grand staircase that leads up to the first floor. Its curving oak balustrades and Georgian landing create a feeling of comfort and warmth. Jameson asks us to follow her, so we pass from the foyer into a dining room with a large round table. There, with the assistance of smiling household help, she gives us a lunch of salmon pulled from the Blackwater, a river nearby. The fish disappears from our plates in no time at all. After coffee, we go into the gardens. Jameson guides us through 5 acres of garden, filled with an astonishing variety of plants, and explains how she came to live here. She spent 10 years in Italy, she says, near Florence, painting. Then 8 years in Norway, painting and showing her work. In the 1990s, when her parents passed away, she and her two sisters took the decision to maintain Turin's extensive gardens in their memory. There was no real plan, she explains, just a love of country living. Their mother, originally from Norway, had planted many of the rare trees and shrubs. Gardens evolve, she says. I haven't any idea of how to change it, but we are expanding. We're planting an arboretum. My sisters and I are very interested in trees. She points out the full green feathery foliage of a rare Kentucky coffee tree, so named after the seeds it produces. Centuries ago, on the other side of the Atlantic, Native Americans roasted the seeds and made them into a hot drink. Nearby are several large magnolias and an evergreen home oak, the latter a native of the eastern Mediterranean. This one is under the care of the tree surgeon. There is also a big eucalyptus, damaged in a storm. Jameson says she is particularly proud of her London plane tree and her rhododendrons. We walk on for a bit until we see the tops of the fruit trees, cherries, figs, enjoying the protection of a walled garden. So do the flowers, blue plumbago, fuchsia, and a special collection of bearded irises among them. The place is an impressionist's dream with its sea of red, purple, and orange. The sun burns through a thin cloud, illuminating a centuries-old stone tower house behind the main villa. Nearby, horses wander over broad lawns, and a number of Irish setters flit about, as if to display the effect of speed on their fine red fur. Jameson says she has 10 such dogs and takes 4 of them with her on the hunt. These dogs live in the kennel and do not share the house with her. Sandy, a Jack Russell Terrier, has that honour. I met Sandy when I passed the kitchen in Turin House at lunch. She barked at me then, as if to say, "This is my domain, and who, please, are you?" As we walk, One of the red dogs rushes up and looks at us with mischief in her eyes. This little bitch is an escapee. A young man tries to corner her, but the dog evades him. Seconds later, she's gone, one with the woods. Jameson laughs and leads us round the front of the house, patting down a wave of platinum hair. It seems as though all is well in her world, where wild things can run free.
Each month, business communication expert Ken Taylor joins us in the studio with tips on using English at work. This month, he gives tips on keeping communication at work short and simple.
Hello, this is Ken Taylor from London. When you're working internationally in English, you need to make sure that everyone can understand you. This means keeping your communication short and simple. Try to use everyday words whenever you can. Let's practice this now. First, you'll hear an English word or phrase. Then you'll hear that word or phrase in a sentence. In the pause, say a shorter, simpler word or phrase that means the same. Then you'll hear my version. Okay? We'll begin. Commence. The meeting will commence at 2 p.m. Start. The meeting will start at 2 p.m. You could also use the word begin. In the near future. The project will start in the near future. Soon. The project will start soon. Due to the fact that. The meeting was cancelled due to the fact that there was a rail strike. Because. The meeting was cancelled because there was a rail strike. Approximately. There were approximately 200 people at the conference. About. There were about 200 people at the conference. Request. May I request you to bring some form of ID when you visit the factory? Ask. May I ask you to bring some form of ID when you visit the factory? Dispatch. We'll dispatch the goods this afternoon. Send. We'll send the goods this afternoon. With reference to. I'm writing to you with reference to our meeting next week. About. I'm writing to you about our meeting next week. Purchase. We need to purchase some spare parts. Buy. We need to buy some spare parts. Terminate. The project is planned to terminate in December. End. The project is planned to end in December. You could also use the word finish. In the event of. Please contact me in the event of you not being able to come to the meeting. If. Please contact me if you are not able to come to the meeting. Sometimes you need to use a more complicated word or phrase for stylistic reasons, or because there is no other good, simple phrase you could use instead. But your general rule should be, keep it short and simple.
If you have a question for Ken, send it by email to language@spotlight-verlag.de. If Ken chooses your question to print in Spotlight magazine, you'll receive a free copy of his book, Dear Ken, 101 Answers to Your Questions About Business English. The vote on a possible Brexit is causing trouble at our favourite London pub, Peggy's Place. In fact, feelings on the topic have become so strong that pub owner Peggy and her husband Phil have banned the B word altogether.
Hi, Phil. So, what do you think's going to happen? How's it going to go?
What?
Will we or won't we?
Stop right there, young lady. This is a bee-free zone. No talk about the bee topic allowed.
Says who?
It's a decision that Peggy and I made on Friday. There have been so many arguments, and once or twice people have nearly come to blows. So we decided to ban the bee topic, at least until next Thursday.
But surely people come to the pub to talk, discuss... Dare I even use the word debate?
There are plenty of pubs in the area where people can go and get their knickers in a twist about the B word. But we thought we would offer a haven to those who wish to keep their opinions to themselves.
Or who don't have an opinion.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Helen.
What do you think, George? Is it right to ban the B word in here?
The B word? What B word?
Think, George. What word, beginning with the letter B, is everyone talking about?
Well, as I'm in the pub, the word with B that most readily springs to mind is beer.
Cold, George. You're very cold.
No, I'm not. I'm boiling. And parched.
How about a nice cool beer, then? While you think of something topical, beginning with B.
But if you guess the word, you can't talk about it, or you'll be thrown out by the scruff of your neck and not allowed to return until next Thursday.
OK, it's summer. In fact, it should be midsummer next week. How about the birds and bees?
It's interesting the way your mind works, George. Beer and sex.
Let up, Ellen. George has had a long day at work.
Oh, so what you're saying is that the only thing men can think of after a day in the office is...
Hi, everyone. Phil, do you think the pub will be quiet next Thursday, or can we expect lots of custom?
Hard to say. I think people will mostly be drinking, though, so don't get in any extra food.
Ha! I know! Beach!
Why would we ban the word beach, George?
I don't know. Maybe because people keep talking about their holidays.
What on earth is going on here?
George is trying to guess the B topic we've banned.
The B topic? What B topic?
You know, the one everybody, except George, is talking about.
Oh, you mean...
Don't say it! How about every time you guess wrong, you have to buy a round, George? That will get your Scottish brain clunking into action.
That's mean, Helen.
If I guess right this time, then you can all buy me a drink, OK?
So you know what the B word is.
Yes, Brexit. It describes a man leaving the pub without finishing his beer because the other customers are getting on his nerves.
Down at Peggy's place.
It's almost time to say goodbye. But before that, why not sit back and listen to this month's short story? In Abandoned by Julian Earwaker, an old car is left outside a middle-class couple's house. As the husband tries to get rid of it, the wife notices something strange about the car.
I woke up early this morning. I went downstairs, let the dog out and put the kettle on. It's not easy making a cup of tea with bandaged hands. In fact, it's not easy to do anything. My husband Arthur was still asleep. He sleeps a lot these days. He was made redundant last year. For 32 years he had been a busy quality controller. Suddenly, from one day to the next, there was nothing in his life left to control. We first noticed the car about 3 months ago, a battered red hatchback on the grass verge opposite our house. People often park there, so it took us a while to realise that the vehicle had been abandoned. Its bodywork was dented and rusting, and its wheel hubs were missing. I noticed something else too. The windows had condensation on the inside. I had my suspicions, but I didn't say anything to my husband.
"It must be stolen," said Arthur. "I'll phone the police."
The police, however, weren't very interested. I tried to distract my husband by suggesting walks we could take and by making lists of jobs that needed doing around the house. But the car quickly became an obsession with him.
"It's still there," he said, each evening as we sat down to eat supper. "We've got to do something about it. It's lowering the tone of the neighbourhood."
The neighbours joined Arthur in guessing who owned the car, how it had arrived there, and why it had been abandoned. To listen to them, the car might have been a Martian spaceship. When I visited our GP to collect Arthur's antidepressants, I told her about the car. "Obsession can be linked to depression," she said. "What else does he have in his life?" I didn't know what to say. While Arthur wrote emails and letters about the car to everyone he could think of, including his MP and local councillors, I ran the house, cleaned, shopped, cooked meals, kept the garden tidy, and walked the dog. The dog sniffed the car with interest. I tried to look in, but I couldn't see much. Sometimes I thought I could identify certain objects, like plastic bags on the front seat, but at other times there seemed to be nothing at all. Or was that, perhaps, a green sleeping bag spread across the back seat?
"You're not taking this seriously," shouted Arthur one evening, after I had laughed when he said that setting fire to the car would be the best way to get rid of it.
"That's because you are being ridiculous," I replied. But I was genuinely shocked by his suggestion. That night, I watched from the kitchen window as a shadowy figure moved silently across the footpath opposite, opened the car door and slid inside. The vehicle glittered with frost. I put on my coat, went straight across and knocked on the car window. At first, there was no movement. But when I knocked again, the window was wound down a couple of centimetres. A large pair of eyes looked up at me. They belonged to a young woman who was perhaps 20 years old, and she was very scared.
"You must be freezing out here," I said. "Can I get you something warm to drink? A cup of tea?" The young woman nodded. Inside the house, I poured tea into a thermos flask. I also filled a hot water bottle and hid it under my coat. I went into the bedroom. I had planned to say, "I'm just going out to post a birthday card." But Arthur was fast asleep. That's the benefit of the antidepressants, I suppose. The young woman gratefully accepted the hot water bottle and tea. She spoke softly, with an accent I couldn't identify. The next night, I took her some food, and for the following 3 weeks, these deliveries became part of my routine. If he had noticed, Arthur never asked me why I had started to walk the dog at night, but he did stop talking about the car. Last Sunday, I took Arthur's evening cocoa through to the TV room, but he wasn't there. I couldn't find him upstairs either. I was filled with a sudden feeling of dread. I ran downstairs and saw a yellowy-orange glow that filled the sky in front of the house. "No!" I cried as I ran outside. The car was a ball of flames. Arthur stood to one side, an empty petrol container in his hand. I tried to reach the car doors, but the heat was too intense. Thick smoke filled my lungs. Tears ran down my cheeks. Arthur pulled me back. "Enough," he said. A scrap of burning green material blew past my feet. I reached down to grab it, but all I managed to do was burn my hands. Within minutes, the police, fire crews, and an ambulance had arrived. A sweet young paramedic bandaged my hands. The next morning, a tow truck removed the blackened remains. The police have warned Arthur that he could face prosecution for arson. But he seems a different man now. Last night, he even suggested coming with me to walk the dog. I still think about the young woman. I didn't even know her name. I wonder where she is now. Whether she's safe. And whether Arthur really knew the car was empty before he set it alight.
Thanks for joining us for Spotlight Audio. You'll find more information about becoming a regular subscriber to either our CD or download at www.spotlight.de/hören. Join us again next month, won't you? Until then, goodbye.